Welcome back to Lit City. I'm Anna Williams.
And I'm Charity Nebbe, and we are out in Iowa City today, standing outside of St. Mary's Catholic Church with Lauren Haldeman. She is a poet and a web developer for the City of Lit mobile app. And we're here. Why are we here, Lauren?
We're here because this is a major location in the story of Flannery O'Connor in Iowa City. She came to this church as sort of a respite, and she said that she thought that when she came here, she felt completely at home. So I love this location. I love the story around it with her. And so this is one of the key literary spots in town for me.
Flannery O'Connor, of course, wrote two novels, many, many short stories, an iconic author, and thought of as a Southern author, which
right.
she was.
Yes.
But, of course, we take possession of Flannery O'Connor because she studied here at the Writers' Workshop at the University of Iowa. How long was she in town?
So she came here initially for the journalism program, but she very quickly learned about the Writers' Workshop, and she went to Paul Engel personally in his office.
And he was the director of the workshop at the time.
He was the director at the time and walked into his office and said in a very heavy Georgian accent, I'm not a journalist, I'm a writer, I want to be in this program. And I think the exchange was a lot longer than that, too. I'm condensing it, but impressed Engel enough to take a writing sample. He saw her talent and brilliance and brought her into the program. So she was part of the program for, I believe, 2 years, maybe 3 years. She lived at the Courier House, which is was a house, which is now where Courier Hall is. And she did not enjoy it there. She did not like her roommates. They played loud music. There's a story of that Flannery would shut herself in her room with a single bulb hanging from the ceiling to write. And she would come here to St. Mary's almost every day to find sort of a space that felt like home and that felt like a sanctuary to her. And she, you know, she would say that all the other writers went to places like Airliner, at the time was, I guess, the writer bar, and she did not feel comfortable there. And so this was sort of her haven as she worked and wrote in our city.
When I think of Flannery O'Connor, I don't think of sanctuary and quiet and respite. She had a very sharp wit. She was very well known for that. How did she get along with other people at the workshop?
Well, I think that Flannery, her writing style and her stories were much different than the way she lived her life. I think she was deeply religious. She was a deeply religious person and very traditional in the way that she conducted herself. And so, you know, it's always fascinating to see the way that someone writes and then the way that they live. It can be, you know, extremely variant and different. And, you know, in a lot of ways, writers, that's how they're expressing the shadow self or, you know, the self that they don't, you know, live on a daily basis. So it is interesting to think about her in this town surrounded by mostly men writers who are, you know, at that point in time, were probably all, heavy drinkers, partiers. They're writing, they're living these lives. And then she comes in and she was extremely focused on her writing. She was extremely serious about it, but she also lived a very traditional life. There was a story that she, she submitted a piece of work to her workshop that had a sex scene in it, and it was very obvious right away that there was not much knowledge that she had in how to write the scene, and that Paul Engel, you know, had to coach her through kind of what the scene, you know, might be off about the scene or whatever. That's an interesting story. A lot of these stories are in the Brad Gooch book that is basically, the biography of her. There's a lot of treasures in there about her time in Iowa City. So,
Lauren Haldeman, thank you so much.
Thank you.
That was Lauren Haldeman talking to me about Flannery O'Connor's time in Iowa City. We were outside Flannery O'Connor's personal sanctuary in this town, St. Mary's Catholic Church on Jefferson Street.
And, you know, besides Flannery O'Connor just being an interesting character in herself, there are a couple of things about her story that connect to the other author that we're going to talk about today, who is Dean Bacopoulos. So Lauren talked about how O'Connor's stories were different than the way she lived her life, but maybe this was an expression of her shadow self. And Dean Bacopoulos talks about something very similar in his interview with you, about how his novel Summer Long takes place in the city where he lives and works, which is Grinnell, Iowa. And there do seem to be a lot of similarities between the novel and real life, but he kind of insists that it's not real. It's this kind of shadow community that both is and isn't Grinnell.
And a shadow, possibly, version of himself as well.
Exactly.
And there's this other connection, that story about Flannery O'Connor trying to write a sex scene. Well, there are plenty of sex scenes in Summer Long, which is something else that I talked to Dean about. Dean Bacopoulos is an assistant professor of English at Grinnell College. He is the author of Summer Long. It came out in 2015, but it's now out in paperback. Welcome back, Dean.
Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you so much for being here today. And I have so many questions for you, but I think it would be great if we start with a little scene from the book where one of the characters, Claire Lowry, goes out for a midnight run. Can you set this up for us a little bit?
Sure. This is kind of one of the first scenes that occurred to me when I was writing the book. I was living in Grinnell. It was a very hot summer. It was a hot spring, actually. It was, I think, April 2012. And I was trying to get into a new novel, having just failed a couple attempts at other novels. And I was wandering around the town. It was a really warm night. I couldn't sleep. And I saw a woman who I never had seen before, about my age, a little bit younger, and she just looked miserable. And I've never seen her in Grinnell again, so I have no idea who it actually is. But she was near the ice machine. And for some reason in my head, I started to ask the question, which I think most novelists ask, like, what if she was out there because of this particular reason? So I invented a kind of story for her, and that's how this scene started. So I'm going to read to you. It's about 25 pages into the book. It's an early scene where this woman, Claire Lowry, a mother of two, who's lived in Grinnell for a long time, she's a writer who's kind of failed to ever write another book after an early debut in her 20s. And she encounters a man named Charlie Gulliver, whose father was a professor at Grinnell and who's come back to clean out his father's office. And I'll begin where Charlie sees Claire. He's inside buying beer and she's outside in the parking lot. This woman had the clearest eyes he had ever seen. He knows this because she is staring at him as if trying to place him, and he knows, too, that he has seen her before. But he would probably have been in high school then, maybe 12 years ago or more. He's not been back here much. At least she has stopped kicking the ice machine. "You don't by chance have a cigarette," she asks. His hands are full. He has a 12-pack of moose head in his hands. A plastic sack of groceries hangs from each hand as well. "Sure," he says. "Follow me. I'll set this down." She scans him, looks to the minivan parked in a dark corner of the lot. "I grew up here," he says, when she seems to notice his Washington plates. "I just got in from a long, long drive." She follows him, and he sets his groceries on the slanted hood of the van. He opens the box of moose head then, pulls out two bottles, cracks them open with his key ring, and offers her one. She steps into the shadows, out of the light, takes the beer and drinks it. "Are you 21?" she says. 29. "Just making sure. If the cops come, I'd like to keep this to a misdemeanor." "I don't think Ashland will call the cops. What's your brand?" She looks at him puzzled. "Of cigarettes." "Right. Whatever you got. Marlboro used to be my brand. Lights." He sets down his beer, goes into the convenience store, and faces the now scowling clerk. "You know her?" the clerk asks. "She your friend?" "I don't know, Ashy," he says, smiling. "She might be. Marlboro lights? In a box?" "I almost called the cops, Charlie. You tell her that. She's cool. I told you I would take care of it."
Dean Bacopoulos reading from Summer Long. Dean, you're not originally from Iowa, and I know that you grew up in Michigan. You've spent a lot of time in other parts of the Midwest as well. I found that being somebody from Iowa, when people find out that we have a convenience store chain called Come and Go, they love that.
Right.
We used to actually, my husband would buy Come and Go branded things to take back to our friends in Michigan because they loved that so much. So was there a little bit of just fascination with Come and Go that started this?
Sure, it's such a bizarre spelling for a, you know, for a chain to have, and they're really everywhere, and people from out of state, you know, never quite can figure out what's going on with that marketing decision. And so, yeah, I actually buy Come and Go merchandise for writers all the time. It's a gift you bring from Iowa now. It's become kind of an Iowa calling card. And certainly, you know, in Grinnell, the students, that's one of the few places you can go in the middle of the night for any sort of food, and students tend to stay up all night. So it does become, in a small college town like Grinnell, a weird little hub. You know, if it's 3 in the morning and you want to go anywhere in Grinnell, you're going to be at the Come and Go.
So you were for this, you went for this walk on a very hot summer night, saw the woman at the Come and Go. What happened next? How did this novel spring from that?
Well, I started to write on a strange schedule at that time. I would come home from teaching. This was, you know, spring of 2012, which it was. This felt like a summer already. It was a very
right.
hot
Well, that
spring.
Was the summer of the drought. I mean, mm-hmm. that was a very, very hot, long summer.
Yeah, it was a freakily hot summer, and I think that alone caused some anxiety for people, how quickly it got, you know, into the 90s in April. And so what I would do is I'd come home from teaching at Grinnell, and at the time I lived like 2 blocks from campus. I'd have dinner with my family, put the kids to bed, and then I'd wake up around midnight, almost every night, and I'd be unable to get back to sleep and start writing. And so I'd write this book from, you know, about midnight to 4 a.m. every night, and then I'd go back to bed. And there's not a whole lot to do to take a break at midnight. Like, you can't even go on Facebook because everyone's asleep. There's not even anything new popping up online. So I would take walks to kind of stretch out my back and to clear my head. And so I think what if I'm remembering it right, I just came home and started writing. And I wrote, you know, a scene in which a woman kicks the ice machine. And what happens a little bit later in the scene, quite unsolicited, she turns to Charlie, the stranger she just met, and she blurts out the line, "I've wasted my life." And once she did that, I realized that she was going to start blurting out things she shouldn't. And to me, that's always a great engine for a plot, when characters ask or think things that they can't take back.
When you started writing this, I mean, you said that it was after a couple of other things you were working on just didn't work out. When you started writing this, did you think that it was going to be a novel?
You know, this is the first time where I did. I think, like, I saw the whole thing. I wasn't sure how I was going to get there, and it went through many different drafts and different iterations. But I've been playing with, probably since my first book came out in 2005, I've been playing with the idea of setting something in a small, more rural town. My first two books, my first book is set in Detroit. My second book is set in Madison, Wisconsin. And so I was trying to figure out a way into a novel about marriage in a small town in a more sort of isolated place. And but once I got the characters, I sort of knew I had something. Yeah.
And you obviously took your inspiration from Grinnell, but living in Grinnell, working in Grinnell, did you have any misgivings about actually using Grinnell in the book?
You know, I think my friends and family might have had more misgivings than I did. I'm a fiction writer, but I'm a fiction writer who really minds my personal life for material. I think that partly comes from just being busy, from being a teacher and a parent, and having so many other responsibilities to juggle. I can't immerse myself in research, you know, about some plague that happened in the 16th century. I'm not going to write anything set, you know, in Italy in 1904. I just can't do that. My imagination doesn't really work that way. My imagination really more is born of a really anxious mess of personal demons. And so when that happens, you know, when you're that type of writer, you really do have to write about where you're at that moment. And so for me, there wasn't much of a choice once I found this book. A few people did suggest you make up a college, you make up a town.
Similar to Grinnell.
Yeah. But I love the way fiction and nonfiction overlap. And I love those things that readers can find that they recognize. And I love that as a reader. So, you know, part of the way you finish a novel is make it fun for yourself. It's really hard to finish a novel that's not fun to write. And so it was just fun for me to sort of, you know, live in this imaginary Grinnell aside the real one during the day.
Not very many good decisions are made in the course of this book. Mm-hmm. So I can understand how other people may have had some misgivings about it taking place in Grinnell. And I can imagine that, I mean, this is release day. So once people start reading this, there will be a lot of questions, particularly from people who live in Grinnell. Were you worried about that at all, that people would think you were writing about real people?
You know, I didn't so much, because I feel like, you know, by your third book, people kind of know you make stuff up. And I think my first two books are really embellished versions of reality, and they feel very much like fictive worlds. But I do think people do read books to try to see if they're in there, or if they know people in there. This really is purely fictional, and people say I'm just maybe saying that as a defense mechanism, but it's really true. If anything, the five main characters all contain like some of my own traits, and it's as if I split myself into a bunch of different characters and then added a bunch of things to them. So I'm hoping people don't see anyone they recognize. I really did try, other than a few like little cameos by people in town that are more like nods and kind of in fun, but they're not critical. I think the people who make the worst decisions are pretty much totally fictional, or at least maybe versions of myself that I've made more interesting. You know, if you didn't have characters that made bad decisions, you wouldn't have literature. You know, Shakespeare is all about people making really bad decisions. And so I love that idea of escalating a story through people doing things that they can't undo. And that's really the kind of work I'm interested in.
Can you read a little bit from the book and introduce us to Don Lowry?
Sure. Don Lowry was a character who, when he showed up in my brain, this is where I really knew I had a novel. I had Claire at the come and go, as I talked about a little bit earlier. And then I tried to figure out, okay, who is her husband? And he's a real estate agent in Grinnell. And I have a really good friend who's a real estate agent in Grinnell. And I keep having to assure people that, like, it's just coincidental. Like, you know, Don Lowry, why I made him a real estate agent is partly because he's in serious financial trouble when the book opens. His house has gone into foreclosure. And it's sort of a big shame for him that, as this like supposedly successful realtor, he's really behind on his mortgage and he's losing his house. He hasn't told his wife Claire that they're about 30 days out from being kicked out of their home. And real estate has always been my little obsession. So I always think if I hadn't been a novelist, I would have really gone into real estate. I look at real estate listings kind of obsessively.
Well, it is interesting because it gives him a window into so many people's lives, mm-hmm. and keys to their homes as well.
Well, I think, yeah, I mean, it's an interesting thing that he knows where everybody lives. And I think he grew up in this town, and then he went to Grinnell College on a scholarship for local kids, and then never really expected to be there. And now in a weird way, he's kind of the guy who sets people up, and what he realizes as the novel begins is that his role in the town is maybe not a stable one, and that he's in a very precarious situation personally and financially. So I'll just read, these are the opening two paragraphs of the novel where we first see Don Lowry. In the hay gold dusk of late spring, Don Lowry takes his usual walk through town and out to the fields beyond it. In the newly turned black earth, he smells energy and promise, which buoys him in a way he has not felt buoyed in some time, and he feels, along with the whole twitching prairie, as if he is on the verge of something either beautiful or terrible. It is always hard for him to know which. And this is why, while walking home, when he sees a woman, her body sprawled beneath a thick, scabbed-up sycamore at the darkening edge of Merrill Park, he believes that she's fallen from a high bough. Don stops at the edge of the park, reaching for his phone to call 911, but he does not bring his phone on these walks. His wife has urged him not to. He works too much. He has chest pains at night, and his face is often lit by a screen. And so he cannot call anyone. From this downhill angle, it's unknowable. Has a woman, in fact, fallen from the tree, or has she injured or been beaten in some way? But as he approaches her, it seems as if she has simply sprawled there for the pleasure of it, for the soft grass and a few stars salting the darkening sky and the moon, an icy coin. For a moment, he wants to lie down next to her and whisper her name.
Dean Pacopoulos reading from his new novel, Summer Long. And both Don Lowry and Claire Lowry are both, well, they're about your age. They're about my age. Mm-hmm. And I mean, they're both going through this incredibly difficult time in their lives when so much of how you describe them feels universal to those of us who have way too many responsibilities. Just the overwhelmingness of everyday life, the description of Claire looking around the kitchen and just not even being able to imagine cleaning it up. I mean, was that something that really resonated with you and something that you observed in friends and other people reaching about that same point?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think that feeling of overwhelm is really what begins this novel. It's overwhelm that is coupled with the questioning of why. Why are we so overwhelmed? You know, and for sometimes it's just you're too busy and that you are doing way too much and you're trying to be perfect. And I think perfectionism, you know, I'll be 40 this summer, and for my generation, I think perfectionism might be our curse. We went to college during the Clinton years where there was tons of jobs and tons of credit and tons of choices available to us. And I think that we find ourselves now reaching 40 and realizing we couldn't have possibly done all the things that were available to us. And so you end up in this weird feeling that you didn't live the perfect life. And it's a position, you know, that also comes with some guilt because you know you've been privileged, you know you've been lucky, and yet you still have this kind of nagging unhappiness. And sometimes it's just a lifestyle change. You just have to kind of cut some things out and refocus your priorities at midlife. Your kids are a little bit older, you don't have babies anymore, your career's kind of launched. And that refocusing for a lot of people can bring happiness and contentment. But sometimes it's that you're in the wrong space, you're in the wrong job, you're in the wrong place, you're in the wrong marriage. And that is where this novel, I think, really goes into the deeper feeling of overwhelm. It's not just busyness. It's that maybe the life they set up isn't the right life anymore, and that's a terrifying thing to realize.
Claire is a particularly heart-wrenching character at a difficult point in her life, and maybe this is because I do see this in some of my friends, women who have thrown themselves so wholeheartedly into child rearing that their kids are now a little bit older and they think, wait a minute, who am I now?
Yeah.
Was that what you were trying to evoke?
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, that is something I saw, you know, very close up and personal in my own life, was the idea that when your kids reach a certain age where they have some freedom and independence, it's really exciting, and they're turned into these, you know, wonderful small adults where they begin to process the world. And you need to rethink who you are as a parent. It can't be your sole purpose anymore. And sometimes that comes with major upheaval. Sometimes you realize that once you start to realize you have more time, that maybe you are over-parenting, maybe you're doing too much as a parent, it can really lead to sort of an identity crisis because that identity has shifted and there's this space now that needs filling in. Sometimes people aren't sure how to fill it.
Something else about Claire, that there are echoes of this in several of the characters in the book. Claire wrote a book and had so much promise. I mean, everybody thought that she was headed toward amazing things and never followed up on that book. And the theme of writers being unable to write is echoed in a number of different places. Is this Dean Bacopoulos' greatest fear personified?
You know, I think it probably is. I've never really dealt with writer's block because it's so much a way I get through the day, to get through the world. Like, for me, it'd be like if I was a, you know, yoga guru and I just quit doing yoga one day. I really don't think I could survive it. But I think it's you know, a metaphor for the ways we get stuck and the ways we maybe over-censor ourselves. And it comes back to that idea of perfectionism. For me, Claire is a perfectionist, and she wasn't going to have the perfect book again. She wasn't going to have the perfect life in which there was time to write. She wasn't going to have the perfect family, the perfect house. And I think at the core of her dissatisfaction in this novel is this really, you know, tough inner critic she has. And I think it drives her insane a little bit in the book. I think all of the characters see themselves as being, you know, put upon in some different way. But I think for Claire, that really comes from within. And I think that might be the toughest thing to overcome. I think if you feel you have an external enemy, you can get, you know, charged up for a battle and try to overcome it. But when your enemy is your own self, it can really lead to some major, well, bad decisions, I guess, and upheaval.
Well, and she is someone who would rather not try than to try and fail.
Yeah. And I see that a lot in teaching, you know, especially when I teach writers who are older than my undergrads at Grinnell, and I do a weekend workshop or teach in a graduate program. You have to give everything to it. And there's this great quote. It's in a poem. I hope I get it right because it's not in front of me. But it's a poem by W.S. Merwin, and it's a poem called Berryman. And John Berryman was his famous teacher. And Merwin, in this poem, and I won't get the quote exactly right, but Merwin comes up to Berryman and says, you know, how can I be sure that what I write is any good? And Berryman responds, you can't. You can never be sure. If you have to be sure, don't write. And I think that question of certainty, if you have to be sure, just don't do it. Don't fall in love if you have to be sure it's going to last forever. Don't write if you have to be sure you're going to be a success. Like, you can't be sure. And if you need certainty, you're going to be paralyzed.
Reading some of the blurbs about the book, having also read the book, there is a little bit of a disconnect for me at times. I mean, there are a lot of people who want to push this novel as hilarious. Mm-hmm. The word hilarious gets right. used a lot. And there are some very funny moments. Hilarity is not, I think, the overarching theme of the book. I mean, how does it feel when you see the book characterized and you think, oh, maybe not
yeah.
that?
Well, it's better than smutty. I got smutty from somebody. I think it's got its moments of hilarity in the sense that, to me, it's funny when we get into places we can't get out of and we say things and that just get us deeper into it. But yeah, I don't think it's a funny novel in terms of what happens. But, you know, having just gone through this in my personal life, like after divorce is over and after seeing that, like how you acted and reacted and fought and watched everything crumble, there is some humor in it. You know, you have to forgive yourself and look back and be like, oh my goodness, what a year, you know, and that's kind of what I was doing as I was writing the book and just thinking, like, about not only the characters, but also my own self, being thinking to myself, like, I can't believe this is my life. And sometimes it's really funny to replay these things. And obviously not always, but so I did try to, you know, lace it with enough moments of comic relief that the reader would know that, you know, I was quite aware that these characters were making a lot of their own problems.
I talked with Amy Tan a while back after her latest novel came out, and she doesn't have a lot of sex in her novels, mm-hmm. but in this last one there were courtesans, so she had to have sex mm-hmm. in the novel. And she talked about how nervous that made her because everybody assumes that everything she writes is about herself.
Right.
So that she figured they would all assume that whatever she wrote, they would assume was happening in their own bedrooms. Did you have some angst about that? Because there's a lot of sex in this book.
Oh, the sex is all true. No, I mean, you know, I kind of would just, you know, I was raised Catholic and I was raised to not talk about sex or admit that I ever thought about it or had it, even though I had two children, like just pretend that never happened. And suddenly I just felt like I was sick of being ashamed of something that is really one of our deepest biological impulses. And it really does, unfortunately, for better or for worse, it controls some of the decisions we make. And it's an important part of a good marriage, and it's important part of a bad marriage too. It sometimes is what keeps a bad marriage afloat. And I just wanted to be honest about it. And, you know, I did think that it was sort of fun to write scenes that push the envelope. And I did that partly because we see that in movies or music videos all the time. And we don't really bat an eye because we expect it from Hollywood. But something about being alone with a book and your own thoughts and being forced to imagine the sex scene that the writer has put in front of you makes us feel like it's much more of a big deal. So if this were a movie, yeah, it would be a rated R movie, and it'd be kind of a steamy movie. But I don't think people would focus on the sex, which is not, you know, the driving thing in the book. But when you see it in language and you have to kind of imagine the scenes as you read them, it's a much different experience to read and write about sex.
So your first book took place in Michigan. Your second book took place in Wisconsin. This one is in Iowa. Does that mean that you have to move?
Right. I got to go to Nebraska next. I'm inching my way towards the West Coast. No, it's funny that the Midwest has very much been, you know, the landscape of my imagination. And this novel ends up in the North Shore of Minnesota on Lake Superior, which has been a really sacred place for me and for my kids over the last decade. And I go there every August. And so You know, I can't ever see writing about, not writing about the Midwest, though I've been advised by people to stop, you know, like to finally break out of this place. But this is where my world is, and this is the place I love. And I have often thought about moving to other places, and I've had job offers, teaching job offers in other states. Leaving the Midwest now seems almost impossible to me. I have a feeling I'm going to, unless they run me out of town after this book, I have a feeling I'm going to be in Grinnell for a long time, but you never know. Maybe I'll have to leave after this. Right.
That was Dean Bacopoulos talking to me back in 2015 about his then new novel, Summer Long, which, of course, is now out in paperback.
And, Charity, I take it you didn't want to take up your torch and your pitchfork when you read it?
No, I didn't try to drive Dean out of the state. And apparently nobody else has either, because he is still living and working in Grinnell, Iowa. And he actually, his first novel, Please Don't Come Back from the Moon, is being made into a movie, but there's no release date yet. But it's got an all-star cast. It's starring Rashida Jones and James Franco. So that is something to look forward to. Read it while you wait for the film to come out.
So spreading his horizons, even though he has stayed here in Iowa. And next week, we're going to talk about another Iowa author, Michelle Hoover.
Right. Michelle Hoover grew up in Ames, Iowa. She's now living in Boston. This is her second novel, and both of her novels have taken place in Iowa, in a different historical period in Iowa. And Anna, you are not a native Iowan. What, you've lived in Iowa City 4 years now?
I think 3.5, 4 years now.
So you've been taking the deep plunge into Iowa culture, Iowa authors, Iowa stories. Are you starting to feel like a native now?
So one thing that I really have noticed about this place is the connection to Scandinavia and the European countries that everyone seems to have family roots in. And Michelle Hoover, it seems like, is no exception.
That is true. So this takes us back to our German heritage in Iowa, which that actually is my heritage as well. And Bottomland takes place during World War I, which was a very, very difficult time for German families everywhere in the United States. And of course, Iowa was no exception. And this book has been chosen this year as the All Iowa Reads book. So it's a book that a lot of people in Iowa are reading right now, and a book that I think has quite a bit to say about Iowa.
All right. Well, thanks for stopping by Lit City.
See you next time.